finishes the story off. Very good, important subject, and significant at the same time. Purity of intention and sincerity. When you're connected to the source, let's summarize it, then you see yourself with someone who knows what's going on.
Dr. Husni, thank you very much for that. And as I say, I hope the listeners have enjoyed our discussion about the great holy personality of Imam Khomeini. God bless him. And there are so many dimensions still to be discussed. We've just, as I say, we've just scraped the surface. We haven't even done anything yet. But let's carry on in the next session and talk more about
God these, willing, we'll do
yeah,
that.
With the, inshallah, with the more aspects of this great personality. But it's enough for me to say at this moment in time, thank you very much for listening.
You are more than
May the
welcome.
Peace and blessings of Allah and mercy be upon you all. Thank you and goodbye.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. وعجل درجه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Agha Mujtaba Tahrani.
هر کس هنگام غروب آفتاب در شب اول ماه شعبان دارای این شرایطی که عرض کنم باشد بر او واجب می شود زکات فطره. اولا بالغ باشد بلوغ شرعی. بعد هم
If somebody has the following conditions on the first night of the month of Shawwal, paying zakat al-fitra is obligatory for him. First, he must be ritually mature. Second, he must have sound mind. Third, he must not be unconscious. And fourth, he must be able to earn his living during the year. Zakat al-Fitra must be paid for the head of the family and all members under his custody, for example, the people who benefit from the earnings of the father of the family. There are no conditions put for the members, like being rich or poor, Muslim or non-Muslim, sane or insane. In fact, the conditions mentioned already are only true about the head of the family and the person in charge of the affairs of the members. Even a person who does not fast must pay zakatul fitra. The members for whom zakatul fitra must be paid must not be necessarily present at the house of the head of the family. For example, if one's child is on trip or goes to university in another city, the father of the family must pay zakatul fitra for him or her. On the other hand, the guests who do not benefit from the earnings of the head of the family are not included in the zakatul fitra payment. However, if some people are the guests of the head of the family, for example, for a week, and use the food of the head of that family, then paying zakatul fitra for them is an obligation.
هست و واجب نیست، نیست و واجب هست. درست عکس هم گفت. میونه مسئله این که زکات فطر چیه؟ از نظر جنسی به مقدار به قول ما حدود یک من، یک سا میگن حدود یک من، از گندم باشه، جو باشه، چه باشه، همسال.
So paying zakat al-fitra is both an obligation and not an obligation. About the amount and material of zakat al-fitra, it must be indicated that it must be about 3 kilograms, and it could be from wheat, barley, date, etc. However, the material for paying zakatul fitra must be the fixed sustenance of the food of the family during a year.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, where we listen to a speech by Ayatollah Agha Mujtaba Tehrani. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
We are on the side of the oppressed, whichever pole they may be in. Palestinians are oppressed by the Israelis, therefore we side with them. This is one of many quotes of late Imam Ruhullah Musawi Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Approaching the 32nd passing anniversary of Imam Khomeini, remember his efforts in warning the Islamic world to the dangers of the creation of the usurping Israeli entity. There is no doubt that Al-Quds al-Sharif holds a prodigious position in the hearts and minds of monotheistic religions in general, and among Muslims in particular, due to the religious sanctities that this city contains, such as the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock. In addition to that, it was the first Qibla to which Muslims prayed before Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, converted the Qibla to the Holy Kaaba in the city of Mecca. Accordingly, there is no disagreement or conflict between the people of all religions over its sanctity and high status. Muslims continued to make pilgrimage to it just like they did to the Holy Kaaba until the Zionist entity seized the holy city of Al-Quds entirely in 1967 and became an obstacle prohibiting Muslims from reaching their holy city. As such, Imam Khomeini, since the establishment of the usurper entity, tried to alert the Islamic world to the danger of that entity, not only to Jerusalem and Palestine that it had occupied, but to all our Arab and Islamic world. His Eminence worked to establish a true Islamic awareness to link Muslims with Al-Quds and Palestine so that Jerusalem would become an issue in the mind, heart, moral, spiritual, and missionary entity of every Muslim, making said Muslims a barrier of defense and resistance against Zionist gangs that occupied it after it had occupied most of Palestine and expelled its people. Palestine took the lion's share in Imam Khomeini's speeches, making all Muslims bear the responsibility to defend their faithful cause, as global Zionism aims from the occupation of Palestine to control the capabilities of the Islamic world and humiliate it. Therefore, liberating Palestine implies getting rid of a major terrorist plot, and this is exactly what Imam Khomeini's legacy towards Palestine presents. It presents the foundation of a renaissance project to confront the great danger of Zionism expansion in West Asia. Welcome to the Middle Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Statements of Imam Ruhullah Khomeini reveals that the Palestinian cause occupied an advanced position in the principles and interests of the late Imam. He promised us that we will see Palestine liberated and that the Israelis will be expelled from our region with the firm determination of the people of this region. Imam Khomeini made it clear that we will expel the Zionists who are still displacing and killing our children and aspiring to expand in our land in all of our region. Since the early 1960s, late Imam Khomeini began his long struggle against imperialism and Zionism, making Palestine the Arab and Muslim central cause and its liberation the top priority. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, producer and creative director at Islamic Pulse. Thank you very much for being with us, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar. Starting with Imam Ruhullah's struggles through the world, the sermons, the meetings, the speeches that he delivered, he used to conduct in various places in all times. He always mentioned Palestine, made it a central cause for him and a top priority as well for the Islamic Republic of Iran. How do you explain the effect of Imam's words on the awakening of the Muslim Ummah?
The Imam certainly had a profound impact on all Muslims. Oftentimes we make the mistake of relegating Imam Khomeini as just a Shia leader. But this is not the case. The reality is that when the Islamic Revolution had begun and there were people on the streets of Iran and they were chanting slogans and they were saying that we neither want the East nor do we want the West, we want Islam, Islam, it was not just Shias, it was Sunnis too. In fact, it was not just Iranians. Across the region, the Islamic region, all the Muslim countries pretty much, there were people on the streets too. There were people who were starting to chime those very same sentiments. That revolutionary spirit exploded out of Iran and it spread across the region. Now, you can imagine, at that time, there were two superpowers in the world. There was America in the West, and there was the Soviet Union in the East. These two superpowers wished to control the minds and the pockets of the Muslims across the region. And so when they saw that Sunnis and Shias are all proclaiming that they wish to bring about a revolution and bring about an Islamic Republic, just like they're bringing into Iran, those superpowers became very intimidated. It shook the world. And again, I have to emphasize this point. It was not just Shias who were inspired by Imam Khomeini's words. I'll give you an example. One of the most prominent speakers in the Sunni world is Ahmad Didat. Many people will recognize him as being the teacher of Zakir Naik. Now, Ahmad Didat, he would often speak with the Christians and the Jews, and he would debate with them. What does Ahmad Didat say? And many of you will have seen this clip, and it's available online, where he says, I went to Iran.
And I witnessed Imam Khomeini with my own eyes. And I don't know what it is about the man, but when I see him, my eyes just started to overflow with tears. Mm-hmm. Remember, this is Ahmadinejad, a Sunni speaker. Mm-hmm. And then he says that everything about the man was Quran. He says it's just Quran. He was emanating the Quran in his words, in his actions. You see, the Quran is a unifying phenomenon. It is common, whichever school of thought you may belong to, the Quran is the universally understood and accepted immaculate word of God. And so Imam Khomeini had completely amalgamated himself into this divine book.
Well, now, Sheikh Haidar, this is very interesting, but fast forward to what's happening, especially in the last couple of days with the normalization ties with the Israeli entity happening. We did hear back in the day Imam Khomeini viewing the Israeli entity with suspicion and repeating his warnings to the entire world, not only to the regional, to the Islamic Ummah in the region, but he kept saying that the Zionists will try and subordinate their presence across all of the region and probably the rest of the world. Can you tell me, what do you think his thoughts and his teachings, how do you think that collided with last year's normalization with the entity by a number of Arab states?
Well, it's actually very fascinating, sister, because if you look at the philosophy of Imam Khomeini, he not only had this unifying philosophy, but he also had a staunch stance against the Zionist entity of Israel. And if I'm correct, he even stated that, look, with America even, we can have diplomacy. There is a chance that we can have talks with America, provided that they change some of their policies, even though America is the great Satan, according to the words of Imam Khomeini. However, when it came to the Zionist entity of Israel, there was no space for any diplomacy, because Imam Khomeini was very clear and very explicit. Israel is a cancer. Was a cancer? Is a cancer. It is not a country. It's not a normal nation that can be discussed with, traded with, have an embassy for. No. Israel is that despicable entity which has usurped the lands of Muslims. We don't actually, the Zionists don't belong there at all. This was the philosophy of Imam Khomeini. Very simple and very easy to understand. And so we saw that many Sunnis, many Shiites, came on board with that mission and that overall perspective. And when we see these Arab so-called Muslim governments are normalizing ties with the Zionist entity, it's a tragedy. And what they've essentially done is they have betrayed Imam Khomeini. What did Imam Khomeini stand for? He stood for Islam. He stood for the Quran. These so-called Muslim governments out there have actually betrayed the ethos of the Quran. And with your permission, I'd like to recite a verse of the Quran because it highlights exactly what we're talking about here.
But
it says very...
The magnificent effort of the resistance, though, slowed down this normalization process, actually put a hurdle in this process in the Arab world, because people in the Arab world are against it even before it was announced. But now, after Palestine, after what happened to Gaza and how Gaza retaliated with this magnificent power against the Zionist entity, why did it take blood, though, for to be shed by the Palestinians, for these Arabs living in those states to understand that it's important for them to be vocal about their stances?
You're absolutely right. It's a huge shame, actually, that it took this amount of bloodshed before these Arab nations. Maybe they start to recognize it now. But look, it was about this verse of the Quran: "In tanṣurū Allāha yansurkum wa yuthabbit aqdāmakum." If you help Allah, Allah will help you, and He will make firm your feet. The resistance, the unified resistance of the noble Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, showed the world. It shook the world again, because it showed that Israel, with all of their military might and all of their backing from America and the other world powers, could not stand against a unified effort from the Palestinians. And so what this did is it had repercussions upon those so-called Arab nations. And what's happening is we saw that there was public support. This public support should not be underestimated,
mm-hmm.
not just in the Muslim world, but across the world. You saw it yourself, sister, in the UK. in the United States, in Australia, in every country in the world pretty much, we saw that there were united efforts from Muslims and non-Muslims alike standing up.
But there's one question in my mind, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, about Iran is obviously not the only Muslim country that supports Palestine and the right of a return and the right for liberation. We have other states, for example, like Turkey. But we all hear, all that we hear coming from Turkey, for example, are words. Why did they not adopt the approach that is brought upon by the teachings of Imam Khomeini to at least ensure that resistance can defend itself by itself?
Well, it requires an essay answer, but to keep it short and simple, sister, it requires faith. When we're talking about Imam Khomeini, often people relegate him to just the arena of politics. No, this was a man of faith, and his politics was the divine politics of the prophets and the awliya. It requires faith, and not every country, and not most people, it's very difficult to adopt that faith. Look, when Imam Khomeini comes out and says, if every Muslim in the world was to throw a bucket of water at the Zionist entity, it would just flood, it would wash away. Now, it requires faith to believe in that. And I feel that that is the main trait that was missing. Another thing is this idea of the world. People get bribed, they get drawn towards this materialistic dunya. And so Turkey, a nation like Turkey, you often see the sentiments of Turkey wishing to be associated with the Europeans. They want this kind of image for themselves. And so it never allows them to get off the fence and properly support the oppressed people of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
When Imam Khomeini, you know, he said to the people that, look, if they threaten us, if the enemies threaten us with sanctions, then we are the children of Ramadan. And if they threaten us with physically attacking us, then we are the children of Muharram. Faith is really the missing ingredient. If anybody truly wishes to support the oppressed Palestinian cause and any oppressed in the world, you need to have faith. And that's what Imam Khomeini gave to the people of Iran and the region. I don't think Turkey, the governor of Turkey, actually understood that message. They'd be in a different place right now if they had.
I want to thank you very much, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, Creative Director at Islamic Pulse, for joining us to talk about this very important matter. It's not enough for me. I need more time to talk to you. This is such an important matter, and what you said is absolutely amazing. It's much needed to be heard on TV for people to hear it, especially the teachings of Imam Ruhullah Khomeini. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the UN Human Rights Council decided to open an investigation into the war crimes on the Palestinian people.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marbo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The UN Human Rights Council decided on Thursday to create an open-ended international investigation into violations surrounding the latest Israeli aggression against Gaza, accusing Israel of systematic abuses in the Palestinian territories and inside Israeli-occupied cities as well. UN officials said they saw no evidence that civilian buildings in Gaza hit by Israeli fighter jets were being used for any military purposes to begin with. Rather, the aggression was disproportionate and might constitute war crimes. More on this following report.
It did not take long after the end of the Sword of Al-Quds battle, in which the Israeli entity committed war crimes against Palestinian civilians, until the Human Rights Council voted to establish an independent international investigation committee to investigate the Israeli aggression and to ensure respect for international humanitarian law and international human rights law in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem and within the 1948 territories. The resolution was adopted in the Council after its draft was presented by Pakistan, with 24 countries voting for it, 14 abstaining, and 9 opposing, namely Uruguay, Britain, Austria, Germany, Marshall Islands, Malawi, Bulgaria, Cameroon, and the Czech Republic. On the other hand, the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs responded by noting that it had previously boycotted the United Nations fact-finding mission in 2009, and that it also now rejects the decision, stressing that it would not cooperate with the investigation. The United States of America also expressed deep regret at the decision of the Human Rights Council, claiming this resolution threatens to obstruct the current progress in the region, citing the humiliating normalization attempts by irrelevant puppet Arab states. What is important about this decision is that for the first time, a permanent, rather than a temporary, one-year investigation committee will be formed, and at an international level, to examine the Israeli violations against the Palestinians in the 1948 occupied territories as well. It is also important because it represents the first time that the Human Rights Council addresses the root causes of the systematic Israeli racial discrimination against the native Palestinian people in occupied Palestinian territories of 1967. Meanwhile, a number of Palestinian human rights institutions are preparing to submit requests for an international investigation into war crimes and violations of human rights law and international humanitarian law committed by the Israeli occupation forces during the last battle, in addition to requests that will be directed to European countries to put officials in the occupation army on trial for their responsibility for killing civilians in Gaza. To discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Eva Bartlett, independent journalist who has lived in Gaza before. Thank you for being with us, Eva, in this segment about the Israeli war crimes against the people of Palestine. Now, Israel targeted several residential areas in Gaza, killing civilians, killing actually more than 200 civilians, half of whom were children, as you may know. However, this is not the first time that they do that inside of Gaza. Yet, it is the first time that the UNSC dared to declare this aggression as a possible war crime and took vote to begin an investigation in Gaza and elsewhere in the 1948 and 1967 Palestinian territories. What was it this time that pushed the UN to actually do this?
Well, for example, when I was in Gaza during the 2008-2009 massacre, it wasn't easy to get the news out about the Israeli war crimes that Israel is committing. So for example, I would document something and then rush back to one of the media buildings to then try to get it out to the world. But, you know, a decade later, more people in Gaza have access to smartphones and to internet, so they can live stream, they can document in real time Israel's war crimes. And there are many Palestinians in Gaza who have done that in previous wars and in this last war. So therefore, the UN can't ignore it anymore. You know, previously, it was easy for them to say, well, we're not sure what's going on. But when you have so many people documenting the manifold Israeli war crimes, then people around the world also are seeing it and are horrified by what's going on. So I think it's the combination of Palestinians having the technology to document themselves Israel's war crimes, and then that documentation getting out as it's happening.
Well, Eva, you lived in Gaza during Israel's incremental genocide against the people of the native Palestinians in Gaza in 2009 and in 2012 as well, and you've witnessed the tactics with your own eyes. Can you maybe unfold some of the tragic incidents that you witnessed as an independent journalist, which definitely amounts to a war crime, especially against the media and medics inside of Gaza?
Absolutely. So in the 2009 massacre of Gaza, I was among a handful of activists riding with the Palestinian Red Crescent in their ambulances. And I was mostly in northern Gaza, so I was seeing a very hard-hit area where Israel committed numerous war crimes, including using white phosphorus. And I know people are aware of the Hakura school, which Israel hit, with Palestinian internally displaced people that had fled from their areas that were either being occupied by the Israeli army or being bombed by the Israeli army. And they had fled to this UN school for which the Israelis had the coordinates, and yet Israel bombed that school. But I documented Israel's wide use of white phosphorus in El Atatra, which is in northern Gaza, in Gaza City itself, in the Zaytun area, in Sheikh Rajlin, and even on the rehabilitation center, the Wafa Rehabilitation Center in eastern Gaza. So the use of white phosphorus on a civilian population is a war crime. Israel's targeting medics is a war crime as well, and at least two medics I knew that were targeted. One was shot at with a dart bomb, a flechette bomb, as he stood in his uniform next to his ambulance, and he died as a result of the dart bomb that shredded him, and he went into shock and died. The other medic I was with, his name is Hassan, and we were in an ambulance going to pick up a corpse at the Isbeth Abdurablo crossroads. And Hassan and Jamal, two medics also in uniforms, in and during ceasefire hours in which civilians and medics should be able to work without being targeted by Israeli snipers, they came under sniper fire and had to run for their lives, the sniper fire coming right up to the ambulance that I was in. So there's the issue of targeting medics, and thereby, by the way, targeting medics, they're preventing medics from reaching the civilians that desperately need aid, which is also against the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. But in terms of other Israeli war crimes, they point-blank assassinated children. There's the Isbeth Abdurablo family, Khaled Abdurablo, I'm sorry. His two children, ages 2 and 7, were point-blank assassinated by an Israeli soldier. A family that I met after the fact, their one-year-old daughter was point-blank, was targeted by an Israeli sniper. The Israelis rounded up entire and dozens of the Samuni clan in, I believe it was in Zeytun, outside of the outskirts of Gaza City, rounded them up, put them in one home, and then bombed it.
Well, the level of horror.
And I'm sorry, Marley, you did mention media buildings. Israel, as we know in this past war on Gaza, Israel targeted, I believe it was at least 3 high-rise media buildings,
mm-hmm.
One of which, the Shuruk building, the Israelis had targeted in 2009 when I was in the building, shelling it at least 7 times with, I believe it was either a tank or Apache fire.
Mm-hmm.
They also targeted it in 2012 and 2014, and then this last time they completely destroyed it,
yeah.
As they did the Jawhara Tower.
Yeah.
And we know that in doing so, clearly this was because they wanted to try as much as they could to prevent Palestinian journalists from documenting what would be many war crimes to follow.
Well, Ava, one of the incidents you once told me about, we were chatting about this issue, and you told me about when Israeli occupation forces opened fire at farmers in Gaza, and you were actually there, but thank God you were not hurt. Could you tell us more about maybe the testimonies briefly about such incidents that the people of Gaza endure while they are being besieged by the Israeli entity?
Yeah, this is a particularly sadistic aspect of the siege on Gaza. They, as we know, they prevent Palestinians from importing or exporting, which is decimating their economy, but then they prevent them from fishing and farming by targeting fishers and farmers with heavy machine gun fire. In the case of fishers, even targeting them with missiles, abducting them, taking their boats and not returning them. In the case of farmers, over the course of the 3 years that I was living in Gaza, I and other activists were accompanying farmers on their land, which was usually 500 or 600 meters from the fence encircling Gaza, encaging Gaza. And Israelis say that the 300 meters on the Gaza side of that fence is a no-go zone in which Palestinians, if they dare to tread, will be arrested or shot dead, usually the latter.
Even if they are farmers.
Yes, these are farmers. You can see quite clearly they are unarmed. They're clearly farmers. And these include not only just young men of labor, young laborers, but also children and elderly, entire families working on their land. The Israeli jeeps will either shoot at them from, the Israeli soldiers will either get out of jeeps and shoot at them, or they'll use a remote-controlled gun
tower. Well, Ava, in a minute or less than that, we also saw the Israeli war crimes not only in the enclaved Gaza Strip, but also in the 1948 and 1967 occupied territories inside of Palestine, like, for example, Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where a number of families are facing imminent forced displacement by the occupation. But we also saw harmony between the internal Palestinian, occupied Palestinian land and Gaza. Do you think that this is experience of unity can actually be built upon for the future of Palestine?
Yeah, it was a historic time because, as we know, there are various factors that have created division amongst Palestinians. I would say, first and foremost, the occupation, the physical occupation, keeping Palestinians apart from one another, but also other divisive means of keeping Palestinians not unified. But what we saw recently with all the resistance factions unifying and sending a very strong message to Israel that they are standing with the Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and with Al-Quds, of course, this was rather unprecedented, and I think that this is a powerful message to their occupiers that the game has changed. They can no longer kill wantonly and displace Palestinians wantonly. They will pay a price.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Eva Bartlett, independent journalist who had a very immense and deep experience of the occupation and the genocide inside of Gaza, for joining us to talk about the Israeli war crimes against the people of Palestine. Thank you very much for being with us, Eva.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please do stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program, or to our audience, and welcome you to the program Viewpoint. In this series of the programs, we are going to criticize a couple of movies hovering around the topic or the subject of cloning. What I had in mind as the host of this program, wanted to focus on five movies, and we found five movies. In each of these movies are going to get a couple of episodes, hopefully. And we're going to start with The Sixth Day. Well, along with me sitting are dear guests, Sayyid Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure being here.
And thank you very much. The pleasure is mine. And Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam. Thank you.
Well, Brother Sayyid Abdullah, let me start with you with the movie The Sixth Day. In short, in the distant future, human cloning technology falls into the destructive, corrupt hands of a multinational corporation. I'm not going to name anything, right?
Yeah, okay.
Well, but one man refuses to be a pawn in this deadly conspiracy, all right? And the whole movie starts with a series of, like, newspaper flashes, and it talks about how cloning came into being, in fact. Based on, like, first of all, they mapped the DNA of, like, some specific animals,
the sheep.
And we can also listen to a biologist talking about Dolly the sheep.
Welcome to Moo Moo Math and Science. I'd like to talk about animal cloning, how they clone Dolly the sheep. Basically, in order to clone another animal, you take a cell from one, then you take an egg without a nucleus, and then basically you get an offspring. But it's a little bit more involved. Dolly was the first animal that was cloned, and Dolly was cloned almost 20 years ago. Here's what happened. Step one was to remove a cell from the udder of sheep number one. They then took this cell back to the laboratory and starved it in order to force it into an almost embryonic state. Next, they took an egg from another sheep, we'll call it sheep 2, and removed the nucleus. Step 3, they used electric shock and fused these two cells together. Step 4, they implanted this fused cell into a female sheep. They actually fused more than 200 cells, and one developed into a full adult. Dolly had the same cells as the original udder cells. What did we learn from cloning Dolly? The main thing was that it helped advance stem cell research, and it proved that the nucleus of an adult cell had all the DNA to give rise to another animal. Dolly lived for 6 more years and then lived from a lung disease. Anyway, that's cloning 101.
Well, that was a biologist talking about Dolly the sheep. So based on the movie, The Sixth Day, then the DNA is mapped, and then they succeeded in, clone an animal in the whole being.
Yeah.
Right? We have different kinds of cloning.
Yeah.
Like we have therapeutic cloning, we have gene cloning or DNA mapping and cloning, and we also have reproductive cloning.
Precisely.
All right. Do you have any comments here, first of all?
Well, for the movie or for the cloning process?
For the cloning process.
So the cloning process, like what you mentioned, you have a few types.
Yes.
So you have the pre-productive cloning and then you have the therapeutic cloning happening. The movie, though, it's neither of these two, though. They were trying.
What do you mean?
See, the movie itself, The Sixth Day, it seems to be about cloning.
Yes.
But in fact, it's a different type of cloning altogether, where you have a human body stuck in a pool of water surrounded by a shell.
Yes.
And then they just put a programming into it, and then the body takes form, and then the information transferred, which is nonsensical in every sense of the word.
Usually media or the movie industry, in fact, gloss it over this way or another, you know?
No. See, so sometimes, like, even if you look at the reviews of that movie itself, whether it's Rotten Tomatoes or elsewhere,
yes,
the movie itself sucked big time, right? Because even when you make a movie, when you produce a movie, you want to make it entertaining.
Yes.
At the same time, it has to be entertaining from, you know, that's something that you can... from a scientific perspective, you could go with it, right?
Yes, true.
So, I mean, we have other cloning movies, like you mentioned, which I've already seen. From scientifically, they could be digested and swallowed.
Yes.
But this one is absolutely out of the point. It's just ridiculous in every sense of the word, where you have a human body made outside the womb. I don't know how they would, they don't tell us. And then all of a sudden, they insert a disc inside the head, and then or through a machine, and information transferred. That's not cloning. I could not find a word for it, so you call it what you like, but it's definitely not cloning.
Yeah,
right.
You're right.
It's like I said, it's not entertaining, not scientific. It's not, because like I said, we watch movies, and some movies,
true,
even though we do understand that it's a scientific impossibility, but yet it makes sense. In a way, right? Like I say, other movies also, they bring a scientist and they talk about it, and they talk about the process of they making it. Well, that's what science fiction is, right? So you create a scenario from science fiction, and then it's more believable for the purpose of entertaining.
But something this digestible.
Digestible. This is not even digestible. I could not put my hands on it. I mean, I couldn't understand what was the point of the movie to begin with, to be quite honest.
But sometimes we are talking about future, and then you're talking about the womb and the egg cell, and then they take away the nucleus of an asexual cell, even from a skin cell, and put it in the womb of a female animal or even human being, and then to try to develop it there, right?
Okay.
But it can happen in a test tube, or it can happen in a lab or something like that.
So
in the near future.
We have no issue with that. Well, that's not what the issue is.
Right.
Okay, so we're saying if you can, because this is the whole idea of cloning, right? For example, with Dolly, the sheep, they took the DNA, they put it in another sheep's womb, and then it developed.
Yes.
This is a pre-productive cloning. But to create an entire human being outside without a womb, that's not even impossible. That's just science fiction. Right. Even in the future, for example, for an egg and a genome to come together and interact and create something, it needs to have that womb right? You could say,
well, what if they create that kind of artificial womb?
You can say you can have an artificial womb. Then I could agree with you. So the process would take what? Let's say if a child is born within 9 months, so mm-hmm. the whole process of that child in this artificial womb will take a process of 9 months,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is even outside the womb, completely science fiction. In the near future, could happen. I agree with you.
Okay.
In that movie, though, if you've seen it, how was it? They bring a body,
mm-hmm.
like they have bodies made.
Yes.
They bring a body, then they insert something inside it. And then the body changes form as well as they're inserting the information inside it. Like there's a machine that just, you know, it sculptures the face and the body similar to the ones that's been copied.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not even science fiction.
Yeah, you're right. Sometimes you know what I mean? Scientifically speaking,
so
the clones don't need to be identical.
Exactly. So we have a lot of science fiction movies about the future and things happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it's something you can digest because it is, at the end of the day, it's a movie for entertainment purposes and it's science fiction.
Okay.
But this one is just... I don't know. I just couldn't digest it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sid Abdullah. Let me stop you there for a short break, and then we'll be back. Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and our dear guest, Sayyid Abdullah, and Brother Hussein. Let me bring Brother Hussein in to the discussion. Do you have any comments on the first part of the program that we talked about, the cloning and the relationship between reality versus the kind of media portrait of cloning in this movie?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the movie, when I first watched it, I found it to be very generic.
Mm-hmm.
Like Brother Abdullah said, it was something like science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like because we are in the 21st century, and this movie is over like 20 years old,
mm-hmm.
We've seen technology that is more advanced and
mm-hmm.
more realistically, or scientifically applicable in this world. And that's why we believe, or we think that this movie is not very accurate.
Yes.
They have bodies, like a blank canvas, and then you insert this disc, and it transforms quite magically
mm-hmm.
into this being that you want. So I found it to be something like a dream, the movie. It's something that you can't really, understand fully because there are a lot of hidden parts, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, but frankly, I just found it boring.
I see. You know, what happens in many stories, novels, movies, which are based on those novels, like Jules Verne, for example.
Yeah.
There are lots of things that Jules Verne somehow foresaw that people of his time didn't understand, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And we see them coming into reality then, later, all right? So what do you think of that? Like, these kinds of movies, in fact, pump something, even if sounding unreal for the time being, but later they're going to be like a reality.
Yeah, well, of course, you can always predict the future,
mm-hmm.
but in... it's always like a hit or miss situation. You can always predict the future
mm-hmm.
using, certain points from history and kind of extrapolate how things are going to turn out later on. So I guess this is kind of what they did, but they didn't really hit. It was more of a miss
mm-hmm.
in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, of course, cloning is quite different now than what we see in the movie, We don't have empty bodies lying around inserting discs in them. So
that would be a surrogacy instead of cloning, wouldn't it? It's like you have like surrogacy movies,
yeah,
where
sorry,
you,
yeah.
just, you know, you, another body takes control while there's somebody else controlling it, or you know,
yes.
transferring. That would be a surrogacy, wouldn't be a cloning though. Like I don't know why they called it cloning to begin with.
I see.
So yeah, so it's like you said, it's not something that, even like you said, like in the future, right? In the near future, even with the with these stories, it could possibly happen. For example, I wouldn't doubt in my mind, for example, if life goes on continuous, we could have a world like something like Star Wars.
Yes.
We could move to other planets and we could have this, you know, a whole galaxy happening. It's possible.
Yeah,
we
possible.
Could, you know, but it, even from the director's perspective or the writer's perspective, it's something that could happen. So when you want to make a movie, even though it's futuristic and it could happen in the future, make it that is it could be happen. You know, it could happen.
Mm.
It, like direct it or write it in a way where it could happen.
Yes.
For example, Minority Report with Tom Cruise,
yes.
which was released like in
2001, I guess.
2001, right? So and I think they were the first to introduce the touch screen, where he, you know, just going around touching things and things moving with screens, right? And like was back for us back in the day, that was like amazing that you could touch a screen with your hand
exactly.
and move things, right? Or like on a table. And now it became a reality, right?
Exactly.
Now we have all screens and you can do a lot of
all the smartphones are like that.
Exactly.
Work,
so
like
you can do a lot of
touch.
Magic with your hands now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it did become a reality. So
exactly.
a lot of things, even though like you said, it's a hit and miss.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is not even a matter of hit and miss. I think they might have had another agenda behind the whole movie rather than entertainment-wise, because like I said, entertainment-wise, it sucked.
Yeah.
It's not something you could even waste your time watching it, right?
Yeah.
As I'm like, and I don't know why they would, if Schwarzenegger wasn't in the movie, it would be a B grade movie. It, like, wouldn't even make it to the box office. Because he was in the movie, it made it to the box office.
Mm.
And it was like, even they, you know, they
this
almost missed it in the box
office.
Like they spent $80 million on it, and they made 96.
Mm.
You made $25
million. Yeah, so it's. Only because he was in it.
Yeah.
If Schwarzenegger wasn't in it, this movie would not make it anywhere.
Yes, exactly.
So we have to see what was the idea of this whole movie they were trying to push.
Yes. Barely Moved made $96.1 million, in fact, at the box office. You
yeah,
know?
So only
but 25. They spent $82 million.
Yeah, so only $25 million.
The budget.
They made, like,
yeah.
profit. And I'm telling you, the only reason they made that profit because of Schwarzenegger in it.
Yeah, exactly.
If it wasn't in it, it wouldn't even make it anywhere.
Mm, thank you very
that
much.
That's how stupid it was.
Thank you very much. Thank you, guys, for listening to us, to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad. Saying goodbye to you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: وجدت في الكتاب، يعني كتابا لعلي عليه السلام، أن قيمة كل امرئ وقدره معرفته. إن الله تبارك وتعالى يحاسب الناس على قدر ما آتاهم من العقول في دار الدنيا.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "I found written in the book which is ascribed to Imam Ali alayhi salam that the worth and value of every man is his knowledge. Verily, Allah, blessed and most high, will take people to account according to his intellects that he has given them in this world's life."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in many beautiful conversations conducted by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings be upon him, he had these beautiful conversations and these dialogues with his companions, talking about different social etiquettes, different forms of behavior, different Islamic etiquettes which are appropriate and are proper for a human being to inculcate within them. So Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam would talk to his companions, of course, among the very many countless and multiple things that Imam al-Baqir talked to his companions about. One of those things, of course, is these kind of codes of conduct, this behavior that a human being should have. Now, these are social etiquettes and they are behaviors which, in reality, are a guidance for the perfection of not just the individual, but of society and humanity as a whole. If an unbiased and unprejudiced individual goes and reads these social conducts and these social etiquettes put forth by Islam, and in this situation, or in this case, by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the unbiased individual will surely see that these Islamic etiquettes are geared towards a utopian society. They are geared towards an ideal society which is made up of perfect and ideal human beings. So in this specific dialogue with his companion, Imam al-Baqir talks to him about using useless words. He talks about clinging to silence. It's interesting, we say that silence is golden. But of course, just keep in mind that this is not an absolute, because when you are faced with an oppressor, or if you are faced with the oppression of an oppressor, or if you witness the oppression of an oppressor, then silence is not golden. In that situation, silence is actually bad. But anyways, back to what we were saying, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said to his companion that indeed, surely, definitely, don't have a doubt about this, that the tongue is the key of all good and evil. Dear friends, what a beautiful statement in this conversation, in this dialogue by Imam al-Baqir with his companion, where he says that this tongue, this small piece of muscle, this small piece of flesh, if you will, which is within our mouths and should be under our control, is such a powerful weapon. It is a powerful tool which can be used for all kinds of good, but it can also be used for all kinds of evil. And so we have to be very, very careful to control our tongue. We must be very careful on